Welcome to Red Inca. I'm Jared Kimber.
This episode of Red Inca, we talk about why no one scores runs in Australia anymore. Well, not as many as they used to anyway. For that, we get on a man who averaged 47 in Test match cricket.
So my name is Phil Jakes, from Phil Jakes Pro Cricket Academy, here in Australia, in Cronulla, New South Wales.
We talk kookaburras, drop-in pitches, grassy wickets, result games, T20 batting, bounces, reverse swing, and why he never managed to make any runs on Adelaide Oval. I've got you on because you did an interview with the cricket.com the other day, and you're talking about how no one is making runs in Sheffield Shield cricket anymore. You've obviously been a player in Sheffield Shield cricket and a coach and everything else. When did you first start noticing that the runs were sort of drying up?
Well, firstly, I don't think there's nobody making runs. I think it's definitely, there are definitely runs being scored.
Not as many.
Not as many runs. Probably not having those proficient, the years, yeah. The 1,000-plus seasons and that I guess we were accustomed to in Australia, where there was always two or three players that were sort of knocking on the door of 1,000 runs. And yeah, we're still having some decent seasons, but getting those consistent performances and, averaging 60-plus in Sheffield Shield cricket is definitely a harder task these days. And I think it's probably been a bit of a trend, I reckon, the last 4 years, 5 years. There was a few things, I reckon, there's a few factors at play here. And I think, one, there's a lot of states that are after results. They're after result wickets. They want wickets that are going to be – produce wins for the team. There's also 2020 cricket, which is encouraging aggressive play, and a lot more shots being played potentially on the up. All right, in the past, I reckon there was a little bit more conservative with their approach to batting, and a little bit more willing to ride a tough period out. Now it's, if there's something in the wicket and it's moving around, the default is to take the game on and try and score as many runs as they can before there's a ball with their name on it. In the past, it would be, right, let's try and get through an hour, get up the other end, rotate the strike for a little bit, and the wicket might change and get a little bit better for us, and then all of a sudden we can play and bat on a flatter wicket.
Yeah.
So, few things, a little bit of a perfect storm. You got wickets that are a bit more spicy. You got 2020 cricket. There's a willingness to not bat that time. And this is not every player, but there's a lot of players that are more about trying to take the game on and hit their way through it. And that 2020 cricket also lends the technique probably not being as solid as it was in the past, and not as big a focus either.
Mm. So just look at the stats. So 2003, the top six in Shield cricket averaged 43. The next 5 years after that, they all averaged over 36. Last year, the average of top six Shield cricketers was 29. The year before that, it was also 29. So you can see that, it's not a small drop. And as you said, you mentioned a few things. We'll get to some of those. One of the other things that you mentioned, and I think it's starting to become common knowledge now, but it wasn't a huge thing when it happened, is that Kookaburra changed the ball, right? They put more lacquer on it. They reinforced the seam and they made it a slightly more stronger seam. They were trying to imitate the Duke's ball, which was seen as a more entertaining cricket ball. That happens in 2021. You basically, the next season is when we start to see all the drop-offs in the runs. And I mean, consistent drop-offs. We had some up and down seasons before then, but it's consistent afterwards. The cricket is telling you that this ball is just moving more in Australia than it has before.
Yeah, see, I reckon there's a little bit more seam. I don't think it swings a heap, honestly. I think it probably swings the same up front. But it definitely moves more, whether that's the pitch or whether that's the ball. I'm not sure. I personally don't think it's a huge difference with the seam. There's definitely more lacquer on it. And the one thing that I saw was when the wickets were flat, the ball didn't reverse because of the extra lacquer on it. So what we're tending to see is state cricket and first class cricket teams putting more in the wicket because they know that ball will not reverse. It will, once it's flat, it is flat. It is hard to get away from. So I reckon there's a little bit of a perfect storm there. That you've got potentially techniques aren't as good. You've got wickets that are a little bit more spicy because they're worried about the fact that when it does get flat, they want to be a long way through the game. Mm. And maybe a slightly different, slightly bigger seam, but certainly not like a Duke ball. It's certainly not swing for 50 overs like the Duke's balls do. And I don't think that they move as much as a Duke ball off the wicket either. But there is definitely probably more movement than what we've seen where that Kookaburra turf ball was quite a flat seam back in the day. Mm. But it would scuff up and it would get like with an abrasive wicket, it would reverse swing. Whereas now, no matter how abrasive that wicket is, I haven't seen the ball reverse since the new balls have come in.
Yeah, I think that's a big difference. Also with the seam, it's not that the seam's more pronounced. It's that it just stays a little bit firmer for longer because of the reinforced nature, I assume. So you can hit it for longer. Also, traditionally, you would have had seam bowlers coming in and trying to hit the seam every ball. Now with the wobble ball, you're not hitting the seam every ball. So the seam isn't getting flattened the way it would have in old days. How much I've talked to a lot of batting coaches over the last couple of years, and they say, you know, at first they were very skeptical of the wobble ball, and you'd have a different relationship with this because you would have had to face Stuart Clarke in the nets probably when he was bowling it all the time. So you'd probably have a different relationship. So, you know, it's a slightly different kind of batting than it is facing traditional outswing or even traditional seam bowling, because a lot of the wobble ball is going dead straight. Bowlers are bowling it a little bit fuller, keeping the top of off stump in play rather than bowling outside the channel. Are you working with batters slightly differently, in how to cover that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just a fact of trying to play the ball late. Like, you know, I think that's the big thing is to really wait for the ball, play the ball late, and make sure that you're not pushing out at the ball, you know. And I said, like a lot of the batters at the moment push at the ball when they're defending. They don't let the ball come to them as much. Whether that's a product of trying to hit the ball harder, you know, 2020 cricket. I'm not sure. It's a hard one, but there's definitely less of that letting the ball come to them with those soft hands and playing the ball late. And I think that's the key to being able to play that seaming ball is to really wait for that ball to come to you and play right under your eyes. And then if you do nick it, ball goes down rather than going to hand.
One of the other things you talked about was in Shield cricket, you talked about the result pitches. And I think that's been going on for a few years now, maybe since, I don't know, even towards the end of your career, I think Shield teams were starting to get a little bit more thinking about, well, we need to get some results here and everything. But the difference is now that the test pitches are also different, right? So we get, stadium like Perth Stadium, and I know it's only new, but it's really a result pitch, whereas we had days where the Wacker could be very flat until it cracked open, right? So it's a very different kind of pitch than the Wacker was. But the one that you mentioned in the cricket.com piece, which I found interesting, is Adelaide Oval, because it is no longer the Adelaide Oval of 10 or 15 years ago. It really is a very different kind of surface now. It's no longer a batting paradise at all, is it? As a cricket journalist, I would travel up to 200 days a year, and I loved every part of it, except for one, this little evil pin here, because I needed this to change my SIM card. And when you travel in cricket, you're quite often going from country to country. Don't get me started on how much this would annoy me in the West Indies, but even going from New Zealand to Australia, this pin was the worst. Well, with the Sally eSIM, they sort all of that out for you. They have an eSIM app that you install once, it's cheap, and it works in more than 160 countries around the world. No more turning up at an airport and lining up for a local SIM, trying to give over your passport and your details, and you just want to get in a taxi and go where you're going. No, Sally make it so much easier. You just download the app before you travel and you decide what kind of plan you actually need. Oh, and if you do that with our code, GOODAREAS, all one word, you get an exclusive 15% discount on Sally eSIM data plans. So go right now and download the Sally app and use the code GOODAREAS, all one word, at checkout and travel like a pro with Sally.
No, it dibbles around a fair bit. They leave a bit of grass on it because they didn't want a flat boring draw on a drop-in wicket. So both Adelaide and Melbourne have tried to design their wickets to be able to get wickets on it. You know, Melbourne's got a bit more carry, pace in the wicket, and it moves around. And Adelaide Oval nibbles around. So, like, whereas in the past it was an absolute batting paradise, and then you get these big whopping footmarks, and the ball would you know, spin out of the footmarks if you were good enough to land it in there, and you know, you get some variable bounce on that last day. Now you get very, very, very infrequent variable bounce, but you do get that nibble and that movement off the seam. And quite a lot of the games that have been played at Adelaide are pink ball games too. So you get that that lights phenomenon as well, where the lights come on and everybody starts getting out. And that's just the day-night test cricket. You know, the Gabba's always had good pace and carry in, and it's always been a wicket that has been reasonably bowler-friendly, and then goes pretty flat when the ball loses its hardness and the seam goes, and then the new ball comes back out and things start happening again. So the Gabba is probably one that's kept its the nuances of it. Sydney, yeah, these days it doesn't break up like it used to, and I think a lot of that's to do with the amount of games that they actually play on it. They don't play very many games at all. They used to play quite a lot of shield cricket on it and other games on it as well that would make the square wear, and then the ball would land on the square as it's getting hit, get, you know, that abrasive nature of the bull eye soil that is in the SCG, and the ball would scuff up and go reverse, and that would be a factor. And then obviously the footmarks and the deterioration of the pitch would make it spin. But these days they're leaving a lot more grass on it. It's starting a lot more spicy up front, even in test cricket. And then we're not seeing that breaking up and that deterioration of the wicket that we normally would have seen in the mid to early 2000s, and, you know, and before that. It's a bit sad that you're losing those spinning wickets. You know, Bell Reeve Oval was always really flat. They're trying to make it so you can actually get some wickets on it now. And, you know, it's quite a spicy wicket in shield cricket as well. So there's a lot of these seaming wickets that are coming into play.
If it makes you feel better, I think you average 42 in Bell Reeve and 48 in Melbourne. I think everyone would be happy with those numbers these days. But you never made any runs in Adelaide. I did check that out. You struggled at Adelaide Oval.
I don't know why, because it was an absolute road. I just kept missing out on roads.
The perfect storm thing you said at the start, I think is really interesting, because some of this was a natural, Kookaburra and the pitches are a natural reaction to the fact that drop-in pitches were quite boring for a little while there, and they weren't particularly entertaining to watch cricket on. And the Kookaburra was getting derided around the world for not doing as much as the SG ball did and the Jukes ball did, and just not being as solid a ball as much as anything. It was going soft quite a bit. So we see these little changes. But as you say, like Bell Reeve Oval, when I was growing up, like, you know, it was just the top three making thousands of runs every game, and Adelaide was exactly the same, right? And now we're not seeing the same things. The spin is going away. All the pitches are very one-dimensional towards these grass. But because you're a coach specifically, the other thing I was interested in, you mentioned it at the top, is you're coaching younger players coming through. At what stage did you start to see the younger players coming through and realize that T20 cricket is changing their priorities or their thought processes and everything else? Like, you know, we're not seeing, you know, that generation of Chris Rogers isn't really coming through anymore. Guys who are like red ball specialists, even players like Renshaw now have to make runs in white ball cricket. When did you start to notice it, and how do you start to handle it as a coach?
Oh, well, obviously in T20 cricket, you know, there's a lot of money to be had, right? But so there's that carrot for players wanting to develop that aspect of the game. But also a lot of the junior format cricket now is white ball cricket, you know, 30-over cricket, less than 30-over cricket. In the really young kids, they're getting 20, 21 balls. They're not getting that opportunity to actually build in innings and learn how to do that if they're good enough. You know, they're getting 21 balls until the age of 12 to be able to actually, you know, to be able to bat and learn their craft. You know, and then when they're getting into under 14, under 16 cricket in local cricket, it's all 30-over cricket. There might be four games of 50-over cricket all year. You know, and you get into the pathway cricket, even the under 17s, under 19s cricket is all 50-over cricket. There's no longer form cricket. So where are the kids learning how to play longer form cricket? They're learning in grade cricket if they're given that opportunity to play it. And, you know, that's not till they're 17, 18 years old. you know, they're expected to go out in a test match like a Sam Constis potentially, and he's played maybe half a dozen, 100, you know, like 20 games of two-day cricket, not very many. So, yeah, it makes it tricky for them to actually learn their craft as well with the format they're playing, as well as obviously that priority of wanting to, you know, get picked up by a franchise like the IPL and change their lives. So there's a few factors, I think, that is changing that longer form focus away from young kids coming through. I think kids still dream of wearing the baggy green, particularly in Australia. They still want to play long form cricket, but they want to do it in a way that's an attacking brand, and it's not going to affect their franchise capabilities as well.
It's interesting. I did a podcast with a guy about 2 or 3 years ago, and he pointed out that it was the first time in history that ODI batting averages were higher than test averages in the whole history of the sport. That had never happened before. And he was wondering if now that because limited overs batting and T20 batting and all those sorts of things have got to such a high level, because as you said, the amount of practice kids do, but also that's where the money is and everything else, whether it made sense to attack more. And within about 6 months of him coming up with this point, Bazball sort of comes on the back of it. Then we see Travis Head and Jaiswal and, you know, people like Glenn Phillips playing test cricket and Tristan Stubbs. There does seem to be in the last 2 to 3 years a natural evolution where those players who maybe don't trust their defensive games as much are just like, okay, so it's tough now. If I can hit two sixes here, this team's going to have to completely change their style. They're going to have to, you know, change the field, maybe bring a new bowler on or anything else. Whereas before, that previous generation would have been like, okay, if we can grid out, you know, maybe six overs here, that ball is just going to be taken off naturally. So the mindsets seem to have changed pretty drastically within the space of 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, absolutely. I can't agree more with that. And that, I've certainly seen that at a domestic level as well. And I think, some players have had success doing it. And, you know, there is sometimes a time for that. There's no question where you can put your foot down and, you know, try and get rid of a few catches behind the wicket by taking the game on and getting a few sweepers out, making it a little bit easier for you. But you're also taking that risk, and you can find yourself 5 or 6 for 20, which is not going to win too many four-day games either. So, there's finding that balance of being able to play both ways, I think, and understanding the surface that you're playing on, the bowler you're playing against, how that matchup lines up for you, and that risk versus reward.
Yeah, you do see a lot of very low first class and even test scores. Like obviously India got bowled out for 46 and Sri Lanka collapsed recently. But you look at the Shield cricket and some of the other domestic cricket around the world, there's some incredibly low scores, and you watch the highlights. It's not as if everyone's coming out swinging, but I think you said at the top, there's a lot of playing on the up and a lot of trying to force themselves onto teams. And also with the short ball, there aren't many players now who take the short ball on the body or defend it. It's like, if you get a couple of short balls in a row, chances are you're going to pull a hook now. Like, and that's very different to, you know, again, how it was looked at traditionally.
Yeah, where you duck for half an hour just to, you know, the bowler would just get sick of it because he's sick of it hurting so much. You know, and that was kind of the mentality at times, you know, when you come up against a fast bowler that was, pretty accurate with his bowling, you get it to the top of your head, or, you know, get it through a little bit faster. It's understanding, I guess, you know, what you can and can't do. And, you know, these days the young players are supremely confident in being able to take that on, sometime at their detriment, sometime, you know, to their advantage.
Just looking at your record, because I think it's quite interesting. Obviously, you went on to play test cricket, and probably was your back that went, wasn't it, after in test cricket?
Yeah, I had three back surgeries, yeah.
Yeah, so you average 47 over 11 tests, and we never get to see, you know, the best of you. But I was looking through your domestic record, and it's quite interesting. And this is a pattern that we used to see with a lot of Australian cricketers. I remember Dave Hussey had a very similar pattern. You averaged 39 for New South Wales. But when you get to county cricket, for Notts, you average basically 50. For Worcester, you average basically 50. Yorkshire, I think it's a little bit lower, but it's still over 40 again. There was a pattern in the old days of Australian cricketers would sort of survive Shield cricket. I remember, I think it might have been Dave Hussey or Damien Wright. One of them was telling me that, you know, that it's like a test match when you play Shield cricket. And when you went over and played county, it was more like a circuit because there was so much cricket being played. And so it found it easier to score more runs. And so your overall first class average goes up. We're not really seeing as many Australian batters go over and cash in county cricket the way that they used to. And also, county cricket is a bit harder these these days because the balls are moving around. I think the Duke's balls are even more juiced up than the Kookaburra balls. So everything's going on. So did you see that as a finishing school, or did you see that as, you know, maybe it suited your game a little bit more, or was it just easier when you were playing in county cricket than it was in Shield cricket? And that is why Australia decided to drop Shane Keith-Warne. Cricket is a game of strategy, of picking the right players for the right moment, or playing the right shots at the right ball. And Hit Wicket captures that perfectly. In Hit Wicket, you're not just picking a team, you're collecting cricket legends, expanding your squad with each new addition. The more players you have, the more options you have to dominate in any situation. And then comes the real challenge, picking your playing 11. Who are your opener, run machine, and Mr. 360? Do you stack your top order with aggressive batters, or do you build a solid foundation? And what about your bowling attack? Do you go with pace, spin, a mixture of both? We've got the Tasmanian Devil, Jimmy, and Boom. The possibility are endless. The beauty of Hit Wicket is that you need to adapt your lineup to your opponent. They can be powerful, balanced, and technical. Each class has an edge over another. It's a tactical dance where you need to anticipate your opponent's moves and exploit their weaknesses. So if you think you've got the strategic mind to build a championship team, download Hit Wicket and prove it.
I wouldn't say it was easier. I think, you know, the Duke ball was always tricky. And the conditions in the UK were tough, particularly early season. They were hard work. But, yeah, I think the standard of Shield cricket was really, really strong in that era. You know, it was like a test match. It was probably as hard, if not harder at times, some of the attacks that you're running in against, whereas county cricket had 18 teams, I think, more 19 counties. So there was a lot more teams, a little bit less depth. But, yeah, like the Duke ball and the conditions and the cold weather and the overhead conditions, it sort of evened things out a little bit. But then when you got to June, July, the wickets were pretty good. And, you know, the bowlers started getting a bit more tired because there was a lot more games on. You're getting that week in, week out batting where you don't potentially get that in Shield cricket. There's only 10 games a year in Shield cricket, so you're batting every 2 or 3 weeks. You know, you get the odd grade game in between that to sort of keep you up and running. But, you know, that consistent nature of playing a lot of cricket, you get into a real nice rhythm in county cricket. And I found it really suited the way I played. And, I enjoyed playing over there as well. And there are quite a lot of Australian players still going over to the UK and playing, especially the top batters. But with the franchise cricket, there's a lot more. There's a bit more mix. It used to be if you were going away, you'd go to England. Now it's like if you're going away, you might go to the Caribbean, you might go to the American T20 League, or you might go to you know, some other T20 league around the place, or you might just go to England and play the 100 or play the Blast. You know, so there's a lot more cricket to be played around the world in different formats rather than just going to play county cricket, 4-day cricket. You know, we had 4-day cricket, 1-day cricket, and some T20 games mixed in amongst it. You know, when I played, it was there was pretty much that, and that was about it. Now there's a lot more to choose from, I guess, for players to go and play. So that first class record doesn't get bumped up, I guess, as much, or and also they're not getting that as much practice and as much development either, which a lot of the batters in Australia, all the good players back in the day, you know, there were two overseas players per team. Yep. Pretty much every top batter went and played county cricket. So they're getting double the experience that the players that are just playing in Australia are getting, where you're only getting 10 a year, you're getting 28 games a year. You know, I ended up playing 200 first class games, you know, and I didn't play 20 seasons.
I think you played a lot. I think you might have played, you played more in county cricket than you did in Shield cricket, despite, you know, your Shield record. So it does tell you how different it was. The other interesting thing there is you talk about the June and July wickets when it gets flatter and you get a chance to just go make a lot of runs. So a couple of years ago, New Zealand basically decided that producing green tops in Plunkett Shield didn't make any sense, right? Because their players all grew up on green wickets anyway, naturally. And what the bigger issue was that no one was making a lot of runs in domestic cricket. Their bowlers were used to nipping it around everywhere and their spinners weren't coming on. So they made a conscious effort to make their pitches at home in the Plunkett as flat as possible. to help faster bowlers, spinners, and to give their batters more confidence for longer innings. That is traditionally, if you look at Sheffield Shield and you look at the old numbers, as I was saying before, that's what Sheffield Shield wickets were a lot more like those sorts of pitches. Is that a part of it? If you're not getting the confidence of long innings as a batter, does it play a part when you get, you know, if you're going out there and you have to face, you know, the best bowlers in the world and you're not averaging 45, 50, you know, these big marks when you come in, if you're averaging 37, 38, are you still maybe questioning your batting a little bit more? Or do those things not play? Is that not as important?
Oh, no, I think making runs is definitely a habit. And I think, you know, you want to be making big hundreds and learning how to do that and learning what your best method is to make those hundreds. And, yeah, if you're not getting those big hundreds somewhere, there's always going to be that little bit of doubt that you can actually do that at the next level as well. On the flip side as well, I think it affects the way bowlers approach bowling on flat wickets. When they actually get on a flat wicket, they don't know what they're doing because they've been used to just popping it up there, wobbling the seam around and the ball moving around and taking wickets easy. And then when it gets flat, it's like, I don't have a method. I don't know how to. I'm going to get guys out. And you know, in the past, it was like, okay, we're going to try and get the ball to reverse. So we're going to go cross seam for an hour to make the ball reverse swing. You know, and just try and land the ball on the side, shine it up, and get it going reversing. Or it might be that we're going to hang it wide outside off stump and ball them out for a little while. You know, with some catches in some weirder positions. And you know, now it's like if it's not pitch it up and nip it around, it's bowling bounces every other ball.
Yeah.
Because it's the only method that they've got rather than trying to actually, all right, hang in there, let's whiz some bounce throws onto the square, let's go cross seam for a little while and try and make that ball reverse swing. But now there's just no, or that imagination is just not there either in the bowling lineups, not just the batters that, you know, aren't used to making big scores. I think that imagination's gone from trying to make something happen out there on some pretty flat wickets. And part of that's to do with the Kookaburra ball not deteriorating as well. Part of it's to do with umpires being a little bit more stringent on bounce throws and throwing the ball in making it bounce. Like you do it once, even if you do it accidentally, you get told off these days. You know, whereas in the past, if you were smart about it, you could do those things and make that happen and then the ball would start to go. Yeah, it's just a different beast now, I think.
It is incredible. I started saying that like England had a rotation policy of wobble ball for 40 minutes and then it would be spin for 20 minutes and then bounces for 25 minutes. And then when that finished, they would just start again. They would go back through the rotation, hope that the ball wobbles again. Okay, it has it. We've brought the spinner on. Okay, that hasn't worked. We'll go to the bounces. So no, I think you're right. And that's why I think the New Zealand option, what New Zealand did, whether they were copying the old Australian method or not, kind of makes the most sense because you want your bowlers to be as crafty as possible and as adventurous as possible, as you said, which I think makes a lot of sense. And then you also want your batters to be in that habit of making runs. You know, you see players, someone like Zach Crawley, who's obviously got a lot of natural gifts when it comes to batting. He's got some flaws as well, but he's got a lot of natural gifts, but he's never been a consistent run scorer in his career. And because of that, you can see that there's like a missing part. Anyway, I won't keep you any longer. Thank you very much for coming on the podcast and talking about batting with me, mate.
No worries at all, mate. Anytime. Pleasure.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work. If you make a lot of content like me, oh, you are going to need help. And that is why we use Minvo.pro, a slicing and dicing tool that uses AI to conjure up incredible clips from your podcasts and meetings. If you make content, go to Minvo.pro to cut it.